first off, we can think about, okay, that's an interesting or surprising message, but what's being left out? What's being omitted? What is the communicator perhaps not wanting to tell me? And we often see this in cases of controversial politics, where someone might detail some statistics around gun crime or around climate, and they leave out crucial facts. So look for what's not being mentioned.
That's Hector McDonald, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. In a world of fake news and alternative facts, how can we know the truth? Ahead, I'll talk with Hector McDonald, a strategic communications consultant who's worked with some of the world's top corporations, and he's also the best-selling author of 4 novels. He joins us to discuss some insights about truth, which he shares in his latest book, appropriately titled Truth: How the Many Sides of Every Story Shape Our Reality. Hector, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You begin the book with an example involving quinoa. Tell us about that.
It's a lovely story in some ways. In some ways, it's very tragic. You may have seen this yourself. I don't know whether it was a thing in Kansas, but certainly in London, where I am, a lot of people a few years ago started giving up quinoa because they were very concerned by news reports in very reputable organizations like The Guardian and The New York Times, The Globe and Mail, worried about a report that the Western consumption of quinoa was driving the price of this crop up so high in Bolivia and Peru that the people who had traditionally eaten quinoa for centuries could no longer afford to buy it. And, you know, quinoa tended to be eaten by progressive, you know, liberal, well-meaning people who were very concerned by this news. So they started giving up eating quinoa in order to help the Bolivians and the Peruvians as they saw it. Now, of course, basic economics suggests that if Westerners are buying up an export from a country, particularly from farmers in a very poor region of a country, with dollars and pounds and euros, that's generally a good thing for that country. It's generally a good thing from the people they're buying it from. In fact, if you then stop buying it, that's a very bad thing for those people. So I tell the story about how some basic truths about price increases in Bolivia and Peru and one or two other bits of economic data were misunderstood by The Guardian and by these other media outlets and turned into a story that really misled a lot of people into an action that was the opposite of what they intended. They ended up harming or potentially harming Peruvian and Bolivian farmers where they were trying to help. So that's the start of the book, and it goes on from there with a lot of other examples of how truth has been misunderstood or deliberately misrepresented in all kinds of fields.
Well, as you point out with this story and others, there are facts, and the facts in isolation are true, but because they're in isolation, they don't represent the true picture of any given situation.
That's absolutely right. So it's very easy if you're trying to make a political point or argue some aspect of, you know, on one side or other of the climate change debate or the gun control debate, it's very easy to pluck one fact out of the ether and, you know, give a reference to that fact, and what you're saying is true, but it may represent completely the argument if it doesn't fairly represent the facts on the ground. And one example that I use in the book is the brilliant argument that Vice President Dick Cheney used when he was arguing for drilling for oil, or oil exploration, energy exploration, he'd like to call it, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And his argument was that it would only affect 2,000 acres, or an area of land the size of 1/5 of Dulles Airport, which is a lovely piece of spin. But of course, he wasn't including in those 2,000 acres all the land around the production facilities where wildlife would be disturbed by the noise, contaminated by chemicals and vibration. He didn't include all the roads that would have to be built to the production facilities. He didn't include even the land under the pipelines, except, and this is the kicker, he included just the tiny little scraps of land on which the stanchions supporting the pipelines would rest. He didn't include all the other land under the pipeline. So it was a very dishonest calculation of how much land would be needed to drill for oil in the Arctic. But of course, it was technically true.
So let's talk for a moment about the definition of the word truth. That's the title of your book, and it seems like a simple question, you know, what is truth? But in fact, it's a very complicated question.
Yeah, you would think if I'd written a book called Truth, I would have a simple definition, wouldn't you? It's easier for me to start to come at it by saying what's not true. So, you know, I think we're very clear that lies and other falsehoods, inaccurate data, these sort of things are not true. But what I don't do is I'm not a Puritan about the word truth and say, well, it has to be something factual like 2 + 2 = 4 or, you know, the boiling point of water is 100 degrees centigrade. There's more truth in the world than measurable fact. And I'll give you one simple example, which is I think most people would agree that it's true that it's wrong to kill people. You know, we tend to sign up as a society to that as a truth. But of course, it's a value judgment. It's not a fact. You could claim that it's a biblical commandment, if you like. But again, a faith-based statement is not a factual truth as a scientist would understand it. So I've broadened the definition of truth to go beyond measurable facts and you know, logic and mathematics to include the kind of statements that we all accept to be true in general life, even though they aren't necessarily backed up by hard proof. And so I'd include in that things like predictions we make with a high degree of certainty. The sun will rise tomorrow. That's a truth, if not an absolute fact. You know, the truths around Christianity, around other faiths, are very strongly held by millions of people. So it would be ridiculous to suggest these things aren't true for those people, even if you or I may disagree with them. And so the book attempts to capture, to cover a lot of these different forms of the truth and look at how they can be misunderstood or even manipulated for, you know, villainous means if people are so inclined.
To help us better understand this, you break this down into 4 common types of misleading truths: partial truths, subjective truths, artificial truths, and unknown truths. Now, you've covered a couple of these, but let's talk about these in more detail and give us some examples.
That's right. So partial truths are the factual ones. They are the truths where we know something is either true or it isn't, but the problem with that from a communicator's point of view is that it's very hard to express the whole of a truth about something. And I start the book with an example of, you know, a simple thought experiment of imagine an egg on a table and show how even such a simple concept can be seen in all kinds of different ways, depending on whether you're talking about a chicken's egg or an ostrich egg or a human egg or a painting of an egg. You know, is it fried, boiled? Is it a cartoon egg? And so even something as simple as that can be very complicated and can have many sides to its truth. Now, partial truths is what we might normally think of when we think about truth being distorted. So that's where we play with the context or, you know, rewrite history to focus on different aspects of truth. But then I go on and look at the non-factual types of truth, and those are the other 3 classes, starting with subjective truths. We've talked a bit about morality there, but I also talk about what's desirable. You know, what do we think is nice? What do we think is pleasurable? We can change how people see the world through communicating about things like the desirability of vegetables versus cupcakes, or the desirability of immigrants has been a big subject recently. I also look at in artificial truths, the 3rd class, I look at, for example, the definitions we give words or the names we give political entities or laws or events or places. You know, these are very powerful at evoking a certain meaning. But of course, they're human constructions, they're social constructs, and like things like governments or supreme courts or corporations, you know, we can change the meanings of words, we can change the meanings of things simply by renaming them or redefining them if we choose to. And they remain true, but they mean something different now. And the final category we've touched on already, the unknown truths, that covers both predictions, the things we don't know if for sure are going to happen, but we still act on them as if they're true. For example, you know, the schedule you have tomorrow, I'm sure you're going to get up and go to work, regardless of whether or not you can say that's absolutely true, that those things are going to happen. And of course, beliefs, the ideological and religious beliefs that we may hold, which drive a lot of our actions.
You know, you point out in this book that it's clear that we can never have a full understanding of all the facts involved in a given situation. But as consumers of information, how can we get closer to truth?
So I think there's several heuristics, rules of thumb that we can apply when we hear a message or read an article or see something on our friend's Facebook feed. First off, we can think about, okay, that's an interesting or surprising message, but what's being left out? What's being omitted? What is the communicator perhaps not wanting to tell me? And we often see this in cases of controversial politics where someone might detail some statistics around gun crime or around climate, and they leave out crucial facts. So look for what's not being mentioned. Also look for if there's a particular focus on one element of a story over another. So is there something that the communicator is trying to downplay that maybe they don't want you to focus on? You know, are they trying to bury bad news in other stuff? Are they obfuscating? by giving you lots of irrelevant detail so that you don't focus in on the thing they don't want you to look at. A third thing to think about is, how is this story or how is this message, this piece of communication making me feel? Is the communicator trying to press some buttons in me, you know, trying to play with my emotions? Are they using a particularly emotive anecdote or using names that, you know, that really get me going? And as a result, they're making me angry, or they're making me, you know, excited, or they're making me disgusted or afraid. And because of those emotions, I'm not really paying so much attention to the facts, to the underlying message that they're trying to put across. So perhaps my analytical faculties are being subdued by my emotional reaction. And that's an important thing to register. It also gives you, if you look at what your emotions are, it can alert you to dangers like confirmation bias. You know, if you're happy to read a piece of news that accords with something you already believe, then, you know, that's an example of confirmation bias. And perhaps if you feel happy to read it, maybe you should think, well, maybe there's an alternative side to the story that I wouldn't be so happy about, and maybe I should go out and see what that is before I jump to conclusions. I think the final thing to look at is causality. You know, we often hear politicians and the like describe certain events and then try to make a kind of connection between them in our minds, in the audience's minds, whether through a narrative structure that seems to connect these events or just by association, they try to link things together that really may have no connection whatsoever. So I think those are four rules of thumb that you can apply in any situation when you're reading something or hearing something. But of course, there are a whole lot more techniques that I write about in the book.
Well, let's look at this from the other side now. What guidelines would you recommend for communicators who want to present information in an ethical way?
It's a really tough one, that, because I'm one of those communicators. I do this for a living. I write messaging for companies, distilling very complex situations down to a few sentences, which are then shared with their whole organization. And sometimes, you know, you do worry. Are we omitting crucial information about, you know, perhaps future job losses? Or are we, you know, putting the focus on a rosier picture of the future than maybe, you know, this company should be focused on? And I think what we have to do is, first of all, is recognize when that's happening, recognize the pitfalls, and acknowledge to yourself and to your colleagues, you know, these are the choices we're making in our communications, and try and be transparent at least with the comms team and perhaps the senior executives who you're working with, or in your own, you know, in family life, for example, try and be honest with your family about why you're focusing on talking about this or that, why you're describing, you know, fresh vegetables in such glowing terms rather than focusing on cake and chocolate. We need to be honest with each other and ourselves about the communications choices we make. But ultimately, like so much in life, these ethical choices come down to us, and we need to be conscious of them and then make them in full knowledge of the choices we're making and be able to sleep at night once we've done that.
I think we've covered some good information in the few minutes we've had to talk together about this topic, but given the book as a whole, what do you hope that readers will take away from it?
Well, I think it's the two-sided nature of truth and communication. So I'd love, above all, that this book helps people become more aware of the ways in which truth can be used to mislead them and equips them, arms them with some techniques to assess truth, to curate it better, to filter it, and therefore, you know, be more inclined to pass on the more reliable truth rather than the misleading stuff that we're fed so often. So that's one side of what I'm hoping people will get from it. But as we were just discussing, you know, selective truth can be used in very productive and constructive ways, and I do it all the time with my corporate clients. So I hope that also this book will help make people a better communicator, whether it's, you know, with their friends and family or in their work lives, and see the positive sides of this as well as the, you know, the dangers of being misled, whether innocently or deliberately, by stories like that quinoa story we talked about, or indeed by marketers who use words that deliberately mislead us as to what their real meaning is. There are many different sides to truth, and I hope to just encourage people to think a bit more clearly about it and use it for good, as well as be more aware of when people are using it against them.
Hector, thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Hector McDonald's book is Truth: How the Many Sides to Every Story Shape Our Reality. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. On Facebook, you'll find us at KPR Conversations, that's all one word, and you can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.